From Maine Public Radio and mainepublic.org, I'm Ari Snyder with the news on This Day in Maine, Thursday, July 3rd, 2025. Republicans in the U.S. House today narrowly enacted President Donald Trump's sweeping domestic policy bill that was opposed by Maine's entire congressional delegation. Now, Governor Janet Mills is warning that it could blow a hole in the state's balanced two-year budget. Steve Missler has more.
Mills had previously said the bill and its sweeping cuts to Medicaid and food assistance would have devastating consequences for Maine's people and hospitals. On Thursday, she added that it could require big changes to a state spending plan that went into effect July 1st, saying it cannot absorb the cost the bill shifts to the states. Other governors around the country have expressed similar warnings as the bill neared final passage. Maine is required by law to have a balanced budget, and the loss in federal support is expected to have a profound effect on its Medicaid program, known as MaineCare. The Kaiser Family Foundation estimates that the cuts will result in a 10% reduction in Maine at a cost of roughly $3.4 billion over 10 years. Lawmakers would have to patch that hole, but it's unclear when they will, because Republicans delayed implementation of the cuts until after the 2026 midterm elections. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Steve Missler.
The budget reconciliation bill that the president will sign tomorrow passed without the support of any of the members of Maine's congressional delegation, including Republican Senator Susan Collins. Maine Public's Erwin Gratz spoke with her this afternoon. He asked her if there were any parts of the bill she supports.
I support extending tax relief for families and small businesses. I support the doubling of the child tax credit that was approved back in 2017 and the doubling of the standard deduction, which has resulted in more than 90% of taxpayers in Maine no longer itemizing, which makes filing their taxes much easier. So there are some good provisions in the bill, which is why I wish that the bill had been separated into a series of bills, one of which would have dealt with extending most, but not all, in my view, of the tax reductions that were approved back in 2017.
Of course, in the end, you did vote against the measure as it stood in the Senate. What ultimately turned you against the bill?
From the beginning, I was worried about the deep cuts in the Medicaid program. That program has been a healthcare safety net for nearly a third of Maine's population, including low-income families, children with disabilities, seniors who are eligible for both Medicare and Medicaid because of their income. And I was also concerned about the impact on our rural hospitals and nursing homes. So that healthcare infrastructure in our state is going to be harmed by this bill. Some of the impact will be offset by a $50 billion rural provider fund that I came up with and advocated for. Other parts will be delayed in the impact because the formula for calculating Medicaid won't go fully into effect until 2 years from now. But we have a lot of rural hospitals that are teetering. They're on the brink, even with the current system. So I'm very concerned about whether they can survive.
You originally proposed a $100 billion for that hospital stabilization fund. I mean, is it safe to say that the $50 billion really will represent only half as much relief, or was there a little wiggle room in there?
Well, there are other changes that were made in the bill, such as the delayed implementation of some of the provider tax provisions, which are part of the Medicaid formula in many states, including Maine, and help pull down more federal money. What we really should be doing is increasing the basic reimbursement under Medicaid for services because they're inadequate.
Were you pressured at all in the last few days by either the White House or the majority leader, Senator Thune, to vote yes on this bill?
Well, there's always some pressure, but I had made very clear to both the White House and to my leadership in the Senate that I had a list of concerns about the bill, ranging from the top income tax rate, which I thought should be allowed to expire for those who are very wealthy. That was on my list and obviously not included in the final bill. The provider relief fund was also an issue on my list. There were some issues involving eligibility checks. For example, if you have a child with a severe lifelong disability who sadly is not going to get better, I don't see the need to make the parent or the healthcare provider certify two times a year the eligibility for that child. That strikes me as a cruel and onerous burden to put on a parent who is the caregiver or on a busy healthcare provider. There were other provisions that applied to the food stamp program known as SNAP that also concerned me. One of those was that if you received a payment under the low-income heating assistance program, that counted as income toward your eligibility for food stamps unless you were a senior citizen or disabled. So if you were a low-income single mom with three kids receiving a LIHEAP payment in the winter to help you keep warm, you're likely to find under this bill that your food stamp allotment went down. And that just struck me as unfair as well. So there were a number of provisions that I discussed early on with both the White House and with my leadership in the Senate. Now, keep in mind that they were also under pressure from those who wanted deeper cuts in the Medicaid program. So there was pressure on the leadership and the administration on both sides of the equation.
As you know, some people are upset that you didn't vote against bringing the bill to the floor for debate last weekend.
First of all, let me say that the majority leader, whether it's a Democrat or Republican, always has the right to determine which bills come to the floor, except under very few circumstances. And thus, I defer to the right of the majority leader to bring the bill to the floor. But in the end, it wouldn't have mattered anyway. There were sufficient votes to bring the bill to the floor, as was shown by the fact that we did not have to have the vice president come break a tie vote.
Do you think ultimately this bill was going to help or hurt Republicans in general, perhaps you in particular, in next year's midterms?
That really was not the basis for my vote. Back in 2003, when President Bush provided a tax cut bill, I provided a provider relief fund way back then. So I have a very long record, as the Maine Hospital Association would attest, for being concerned about the health of our rural health care network.
Hospital officials in Maine are also raising concerns about how the massive budget bill will affect facilities across Maine, particularly those in rural areas. Kevin Miller has more.
President Trump's so-called One Big Beautiful Bill pays for extending the 2017 tax cuts and his administration's border security initiatives by cutting roughly $1 trillion from Medicaid and Affordable Care Act marketplaces. Various studies project that anywhere from 40,000 to 60,000 Maine residents could lose health insurance as a result of the changes, and that would put an additional financial strain on hospitals, especially rural hospitals, that cover uninsured people who come to emergency rooms for care.
there's hospitals that are at risk today because of a number of difficult financial challenges.
Jeff Austin is Vice President of Government Affairs at the Maine Hospital Association.
Anything that adds to it, including congressional action or recession, state action, all of it is a concern. We've seen one close. We have a few others that are, in our opinion, pretty precarious situations, you know, without any policy changes. So, yeah, we have concerns.
K.D. Fulham-Harris, Chief Government Affairs Officer at Maine Health, said the bill will, quote, add significant stress to Maine's hospitals, which are already struggling to maintain access to care for their communities. Maine Health operates 7 rural hospitals, as well as Maine Medical Center. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Kevin Miller.
State lawmakers have approved a broad set of zoning changes that advocates say will remove some common barriers to building more housing in Maine. Nicolo Grisco has more.
The changes allow additional housing units on lots in municipal designated growth areas. The new law also limits the municipal review process for projects with 4 units or fewer. Laura Mitchell of the Maine Affordable Housing Coalition says the law promotes development on smaller lots and in areas with existing water, sewer, and other infrastructure, which should help lower construction costs.
We really think it will open the door for new types of housing, whether it's a triplex or a quadplex, that just aren't getting built these days like they were maybe 75 years ago as workforce housing in Maine.
The law also allows affordable housing to be built one story higher than what's typically allowed, which Mitchell says should encourage developers to add more units to a project. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Nicole Ugrisco.
A recent heat wave drove historic demand for electricity in New England, but experts say soaring need was offset by rooftop solar arrays. Mary Kate Colapietro is with grid operator ISO New England.
And without their production, or the peak, which would be that highest demand level of the day, would have actually happened earlier, and the amount would have been higher.
Because so-called behind-the-meter solar is used by homes and businesses that produce it, it lowers overall demand for power. Colapietro says that keeps the grid reliable when it's under strain. Last year, New England had 100 days when power demand went down in the middle of the day, thanks to rooftop solar production. At the same time, Maine is poised to get a new state department tasked with managing energy programs. And as Peter McGuire reports, the agency has the authority to add new generation to the state grid as Maine aims for 100% clean energy by 2040.
The Department of Energy Resources was authorized by lawmakers this session. The cabinet-level agency will replace the governor's energy office, which has had growing authority and responsibilities in recent years. The department will lead the state's energy policy and address electric costs, reliability, and outdated infrastructure. It also has the power to procure new clean energy projects through competitive bidding. In a statement, Governor Janet Mills says establishing the department is, quote, an important step towards an energy future that works for Maine's people. Until the department was created, Maine was among just a handful of states without a cabinet-level energy agency. The department will launch later this year with a commissioner appointed by the governor and confirmed by the legislature. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Peter McGuire.
The recent elimination of the USDA's local food purchasing assistance program is forcing immigrant farmers in Maine and the communities they feed to scramble. But as Nora Sachs reports, farmers are also cultivating grassroots solutions.
It's a sunny, sticky afternoon, and Habiba Salat bends over tidy rows of knee-high vegetables in a sprawling field at Liberation Farms in Wales. So what are you working on right now?
Weeding my tomato and squash.
Salat is one of about 20 Somali Bantu farmers who grow crops for market and wholesale at the 100-acre farm, which is owned and run by the Lewiston-based Somali Bantu Community Association. Muhyiddin Liba, the organization's director, is translating from Maymay to English. Salat is cheerful, until we start talking about the recent cancellation of their local food purchasing assistance contract.
Yeah, when I heard that, I just really got confused. All the markets we have been working towards is gone.
Until the program's abrupt termination in March, The LFPA allowed disadvantaged farmers to earn a fair wage growing healthy food and distributing it to underserved communities. Last year, Liberation Farms received $75,000 through the program, which is about half of all their wholesale accounts. The funding made it possible for farmers to get paid to donate fresh produce and culturally familiar crops, like amaranth greens and African flint corn, to food pantries and directly to community members. According to Good Shepherd Food Bank, the LFPA would have provided $1.25 million and an estimated $500,000 of local produce to hungry Mainers over the next 3 years.
It helps both farmers and the low-income communities, like the farmers, to get access to market and the low-income community get fresh veggies.
And that's why Liba says when he first heard the news, he thought it was a lie.
So I was saying, oh, there's no way they can cut this program. You know, if they care about people and welfare of people, they would not cut this. But that wasn't true.
According to Maine's Roadmap to End Hunger, African immigrants experience the highest rate of food insecurity in the entire state. 51% do not have consistent access to enough quality food. And the cancellation of LFPA occurred at the same time as President Trump's immigration crackdown that has sowed fear in many communities. And for farmers, the timing was particularly tough.
Our seeds were ordered, and we already started greenhouse work. And we were thinking we have the money we need and the markets we need to fulfill 2025 growing season.
Producers like Habiba Salat, who depend on farming for their livelihood, were left scrambling.
I thought we could have a farm this year, but I just decided to continue farming.
Muhyiddin Liba says that was the unanimous response among Somali Bantu farmers he works with. Despite the economic risk, they did what they do every season: sow seeds, prepare the soil, plant their crops, and see what happens. About 15 miles away, a similar situation is unfolding in Lewiston at the New Roots Cooperative Farm, which is now in its 10th season. Weeding beets in head-to-toe maroon fabric and flip-flops, I meet
Batola Ismail.
She's one of four elder Somali Bantu farmer owners who came to Maine in the early 2000s as refugees and now grow and sell crops together at
Farmers Market, CSA, Wholesale.
What is your biggest market?
Biggest market, wholesale.
Wholesale?
Yeah, but this year, I don't know, maybe.
New Roots farmers were also counting on the federal funding to come through this year. It helps them distribute fresh food to more than 150 families every week. But farm coordinator Omar Hassan says 2025 is shaping up to be one of their hardest seasons yet. The loss of LFPA funding and some other income streams means that
per farmer, we're looking at least 30% of their income.
Hassan also works with a lot of the youth and families in the Lewiston area who receive the donated produce through local organizations.
It's a long line of disappointment right now. A lot of people are really devastated.
Now that the initial shock has worn off, farming groups in Maine are banding together to try to patch the gaping hole that LFPA and other federal programs have left. First, Liberation Farms, New Roots, and Portland-based nonprofit Cultivating Community stood up the Immigrant Farmers Fund to help the farmers get through this season. So far, they've raised about $80,000. Out of that effort sprouted the Grassroots Farm to Neighbor campaign, which involves seven equity-focused food and farm organizations statewide. The network hopes to raise $750,000 to create longer-term, sustainable solutions for expanding local food access and supporting underserved farmers in Maine. But that will take time. Meanwhile, immigrant farmers like Habiba Salat continue to tend and harvest their crops, not yet knowing whether they'll be able to sell them or if they'll end up giving them away for free. Either way,
This is some food that we knew from back home Africa. And I'm so happy to be the person producing it after a long time of not getting it.
For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Nora Sachs.
And that's today's Maine News. For more stories, visit mainepublic.org. Coming up on Maine Calling at 11 tomorrow morning, Everyday Heroes. I'm Ari Snyder. Thanks for listening.